Juneau Afternoon is next. We'll get an update on activities at the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, details about Bike to Work Day. We'll talk with members of Third Coast Percussion about their performances during this year's Juneau Jazz and Classics Festival, and we'll get the details about the next meeting of Wishkanade EI. That, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more, live at 3 on K2.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. This spring, more than 170 nations signed on to the Paris Agreement, a comprehensive climate change agreement intended to slow global warming by reducing emissions while providing support for developing countries impacted by climate change. But as Tristan Autone reports, at the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues taking place in New York, Indigenous advocates are still fighting for a place at the negotiating table.
When it comes to the Paris Agreement, state parties are the only entities able to negotiate how the planet will deal with climate change. That means Indigenous people who are not state entities are excluded from the conversations. Akimarin Olariama is with Indigenous Livelihoods Enhancement Partners, an organization based in Kenya. He says because many Indigenous people are dependent on land for sustenance, they are more vulnerable to climate change, and worries that international interventions like clean energy projects such as wind farms could be used to dispossess Indigenous peoples of their lands and livelihoods.
As people of the land, we pay the highest negative price for this kind of interventions.
Riamet says that while there's been a strong global will to implement the agreement, there's still work to be done to protect Aboriginal communities.
As Indigenous people, we need to be ahead of the pack so that as we move from negotiation to implementation, our voice and perspectives are recognized, hopefully, and respected.
Riamet hopes negotiations will involve more Indigenous people in the future, and that global organizations provide needed funding to help Aboriginal communities influence international decisions. For National Native News, I'm Tristan Autone.
A proposal to create a national monument on federal land surrounding Grand Canyon National Park would set aside 1.7 million acres for conservation. Tribal leaders and some members of Congress have recently stepped up efforts to urge President Obama to make the declaration. Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports.
Leaders of the Navajo, Havasupai, Hualapai, and Hopi tribes say a national monument designation would preserve ancestral lands and sacred sites throughout the region. They also say it would protect tribal health and water resources by outlawing uranium mining in the area. Democratic Arizona Congressman Raul Grijalva introduced a bill last year that would create the Greater Grand Canyon Heritage National Monument. Congress is unlikely to consider it, however, and he hopes the bill will be a template for President Obama to declare the monument through the Antiquities Act.
The nexus of the Antiquities Act is Native Nations, the preservation of their culture and their history, and this certainly more than qualifies for that. It is the Grand Canyon, an icon of America. It's one of the symbols of democracy in this country, my lord. This is something all Americans own.
Obama has designated more national monuments than any other president and has protected more than 260 million acres. Arizona Republican Congressman Paul Gosar opposes the monument. He introduced a bill that would curtail the President's Antiquities Act powers. Gosar says the creation of a Grand Canyon National Monument would restrict hunting and recreation in the area and threaten timber harvests and other economic activity. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
Attorneys announced today a $38 million grant distribution process will begin next week involving the Keepsiegel Farmer Settlement. One-time competitive awards are being made available for nonprofits, tribal programs, and educational institutions which provide services to Native American farmers and ranchers. The application process begins May 25th and runs through June 24th. The 2010 class action settlement of more than $600 million was between Native farmers and ranchers and the U.S. Department of Agriculture over racial discrimination claims involving farm loans. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. And by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. If you or a loved one suffer from alcohol addiction, hear how recovery is possible from those who've had their day one at nativenews.net. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And welcome to a Juneau Afternoon. I'm Lori Scandling, and I'm here with our producer, Jeff Brown. Let's take a quick look at the weather. Tonight through Wednesday, it will be mostly cloudy, with numerous showers becoming scattered on Wednesday morning. Highs around 55 will have light winds. The good news is it will become sunny on Thursday, with highs around 66, and that looks like it will continue for at least a couple of days with a decent-looking weekend ahead. Glad you're with us this afternoon. Our first guests are Drs. Jesse Barker and Caitlin Stern. They are researchers who met at Cornell University, and they're in Juneau for 6 weeks for a very particular reason. Welcome. Glad that you're here. Have either of you ever been to Alaska before?
I actually grew up in Haines, so this is close to home for me.
So you get Southeast Alaska?
Yeah, I love it here.
And Jesse, you're Danish, is that correct?
No, I'm actually English originally. As you said, we met in grad school in the US. I was also living in Arizona for the past 3 years, and I just moved back to Europe, to Denmark. But yeah, I'm really excited to be back in the US, and I'm really interested in finding out more about Tlingit culture now I'm here.
So talk a little bit about your specific research project. And Caitlin, you've answered my question maybe a little bit. I was going to say, why Tlingit people of
right.
the Southeast region? But perhaps your experience in this region has provided some background for that.
Yeah.
But tell us what the research project is.
Sure. So our study focuses on how Alaska Native people perceive their own identities and how those identities shape their interactions with other people. And one reason that we wanted to do this work with Tlingit people in Southeast Alaska is that traditionally in Tlingit culture, people have really interesting, complex identities with several different components that are all important in shaping how people perceive themselves and others. So examples of that are things like people's moieties, their kwan or home community, as well as their clan identity. And all of these are important parts of who people are.
Does everyone have a cultural identity?
I think so.
Yeah, and I think the interesting thing is that people can have different identities in different contexts, and that can also shape your interactions with other people. So, for example, if you perceive that you have some kind of shared identity or shared aspect of your identity with someone else, then that could lead you consciously or unconsciously to interact in a different way with that person than with somebody else with whom you may not perceive that you have some shared component of your identity.
So, for example, we might act, and in fact, probably most people do act differently if they're in their home setting with very familiar relationships, with long set practices or traditions than one would in, say, a more formal situation, such as a classroom,
sure,
for example.
Absolutely. And also, like, how you identify yourself to other people changes depending on your context. So, for example, if someone here in Juneau asks you where you're from, you might give a very different answer than if you are down south and they ask you where you're from, right? So you might give some more specific information when you're in a place where you already have more in common with a person.
So, Caitlin, you grew up in Tlingit country. What are you thinking you might reveal or uncover that you haven't already perhaps experienced or learned or witnessed through friendships or your growing up?
Yeah, so I think a major goal of our project is to increase general understanding of Alaska Native culture and specifically Tlingit culture because in the academic literature, there's actually very little published about that culture. And we both think it's fascinating, and we would like there to be more understanding of the way the culture works and that people interact with and identify themselves.
How will you conduct the research? How do you determine what the structure will be and with whom you're going to speak?
So we're actually looking for people to take part in the study. So we're going to be carrying out a couple of things that we'd like people to participate in. The first is going to be surveys. So we're going to ask people questions about how they perceive their own identity and identities of others. It's going to be primarily online, although people can come into the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute here in downtown Juneau and also fill out surveys using pen and paper. So all of those answers will be completely confidential. Everything will be anonymous, and we'll also be compensating people for taking part, so around $15 for completing a survey. We're also, after that, looking for people to take part in a decision-making group activity. So this is looking at the aspect of the study of people's identity shaping their interactions with others. So that will also be online, and we'll have iPads available for people to use who want to take part in that study. And again, we'll compensate people for taking part, and it will also be completely confidential.
And that's a live face-to-face group activity?
That will actually also be an online activity. So again, we want to make sure that people feel confident that anything they're doing in the study is completely confidential, and that nobody else, either any of the researchers in the study or any of the other participants in the study, will know what they're doing.
So for a study to be valid, typically, in a scientific way, you need a certain size of a group. What is your goal in terms of critical mass in order to have what you hope will be helpful, valid information on more of a meta level?
Yeah, I mean, so of course, from our perspective, as many people as possible is ideal, not only just for scientific validity, but because we really want a wide range of perspectives, and we think that people of different ages and from different backgrounds have very different experiences. So we want to incorporate as many of those perspectives and experiences as possible. We will be recruiting people here in Juneau and also in Haines, and we're hoping that between those communities we'll have sufficient numbers to be able to say something interesting about these issues.
So both Haines and Juneau tend to be predominantly white communities. What about villages where one's cultural identity might be somewhat different than living in a more urbanized culture where the dominant population is white?
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if you might be going to a traditional village
right.
as well.
So we will be working hopefully with people from Klakwan. We're hoping that they will participate in our study when we're up in Haines, and that is a Native village. Also, it seems that in Juneau, there are many people who come in who move here from Native villages, so may have that background in terms of where they grew up or where they feel the strongest ties to. Another thing that's important to say is that this is preliminary work, so this is a pilot project where we're trying out the study and seeing whether this works, and in future we may be able to expand to working in communities such as like Huna or Angoon that have a majority Native population.
Are you going into this with an hypothesis?
Yes. Well, the kind of shortest hypothesis is that people's perceptions of whether they share an identity with others will affect their interactions with those other people. We are not sure yet how that will explicitly play out with the different types of identities that people here share, because those the subtleties of different components of people's identities are so different in different cultures. We both have experience working on these kinds of questions with people in other places and other countries. And so we're really excited to be here and finding out some of the specifics about Tlingit culture, which we hope will kind of increase knowledge of Native Alaskan kind of group and cultural interactions, as well as telling us something about people's interactions more generally, because most of the studies on kind of identity and group interactions that psychologists and anthropologists have done have been limited to populations in Western Europe and kind of Anglo-American culture. So there is a lot of scientific research, anthropological research on group interactions, but it's mostly on very kind of uniform populations and also mostly university students, actually. So that was another motivation behind this study, was to include a more kind of diverse group of people in this kind of research.
Do you have a definition for what is Alaska Native in terms of who may participate in the survey?
We're asking that participants be either tribal members or Native corporation members. But what we really care about for the purposes of the study is that people self-identify as Alaska Native. We're really interested in their own self-perceptions and the identities that they feel are most important to them.
And you've got, what, about 6 weeks to gather your research here?
Until the end of June, yeah.
So for listeners who would like to participate in the survey or at least learn more about the kind of research you're doing and find out about if they would like to participate, what is the best way for them to learn about it? And if they choose to participate, where do they go to take the survey?
So they can call us. The phone number is 617-417-2469. They can also email us at alaskastudy2016@gmail.com. There are posts about our study with more information on the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute Facebook page. And they can also contact the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute directly, and they will relay any information to us.
When do you hope to have the study completed in terms of drawing your conclusions after you've done, you talked about this as preliminary work. Talk a little bit about what's the follow-up and when will your conclusions be published?
Sure. So we're hoping to have some preliminary results by the end of this six-week period. We're going to be giving a community lecture at the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute before we leave. We don't have a date set for that yet. We are both going to be leaving Juneau on towards the end of June, so it'll be sometime around the 20th or so of June. And again, we'll post that on our on the Facebook page, and anyone who's interested can feel free to call or email us about that. So we'll be giving an overview of whatever preliminary results we have then. We'll be writing the results up for publication in the academic journal later in the year, and also we'll provide a copy of that and also a publicly available report for the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, also the public library here in Juneau and in Haines for anybody who's interested in reading that. And again, we'll post details of that on our Facebook page whenever that's ready.
Is it appropriate to call you social anthropologists or social psychologists? What is your academic realm?
So both of us are trained as behavioral biologists. The grant that is funding this research from the National Science Foundation is through the Cultural Anthropology Program. The types of questions that we're working on for this project are really interdisciplinary. So people from many different academic disciplines try to answer these questions, and we actually are collaborating with anthropologists and people who study cultural evolution, as well as our own background in behavior, to try to get at these questions.
Well, thank you so much. I hope you'll alert us when the lecture has been set. We've been talking with Jesse Barker and Caitlin Stern. They are behavioral biologists of Cornell University, where they decided to collaborate on a study of the cultural cultural identity of Alaska Natives, specifically Southeast Alaska Tlingit people. If you are listening and you are a shareholder and you would like to know more about the study that they're doing, which is primarily online, take a look at alaskastudy2016@gmail.com and send Jesse or Caitlin an email, or check out the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute Facebook page for more information on the cultural identity study. Thank you for taking time
to come
to us today.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 17th of May, 2016. It's the birthday of Gary Paulson, born in Minneapolis, 1939, ran away from home when he was 14, joined the carnival, worked as a construction worker, engineer, sailor. He was a ranch hand, working nights as a satellite technician for an aerospace company in California, when he was struck by the inspiration to become a writer. He walked off the job, never went back. Most recent novels, Woods Runner, Lawn Boy Returns, and Liar, Liar. It's the birthday of the woman who was given credit for writing the first stream of consciousness novel in English, Dorothy Richardson, born Abingdon, just south of Oxford, 1873, the novel Pointed Roofs, published in 1915. She disliked the term stream of consciousness. She referred to it as an interior monologue. Pointed Roofs was the first in a 13-novel series called Pilgrimage, based on Richardson's life. Virginia Woolf credited Dorothy Richardson with inventing the psychological sentence of the feminine gender. It was on this date, 1954, the Supreme Court ruled that school segregation violated the 14th Amendment. An 8-year-old girl named Linda Brown in Topeka, Kansas, had to walk 21 blocks every day to an all-black elementary school, though she lived just 7 blocks from another elementary school for white children. Her father, Oliver Brown, asked that she be allowed to attend the white school. The principal refused, so he sued in court, and it came to the Supreme Court. The legal basis for segregation came from an 1896 Supreme Court decision, Plessy v. Ferguson, establishing that separate facilities for black and white students were constitutional as long as they were equal. When Brown v. Board of Education came before the Supreme Court in 1952, most of the justices were personally opposed to segregation, but only 4 of them openly supported overturning that precedent. And then in September 1953, Chief Justice Fred Vinson died of a heart attack. President Eisenhower nominated Earl Warren as the new Chief Justice, a man who devoted himself to the cause of civil rights. Warren's vote made the decision 5-4, but Justice Warren wanted a unanimous decision, so he rounded up the votes. The final holdout was Justice Stanley Reed from Kentucky, and when the decision was read, Justice Reed burst into tears. Here's a poem by Seamus Heaney entitled The Skylight. You were the one for skylights. I opposed cutting into the seasoned tongue and groove of pitch pine. I liked it low and closed, its claustrophobic nest up in the roof effect. I liked the snuff-dry feeling, the perfect trunk-lid fit of the old ceiling. Under there was all hutch and hatch. The blue slates kept the heat like midnight thatch. But when the slates came off, extravagant sky entered and held surprise wide open. For days I felt like an inhabitant of that house where the man sick of the palsy was lowered through the roof, had his sins forgiven, was healed, took up his bed, and walked away. The Skylight, a poem by Seamus Heaney, from Opened Ground, published by Frere, Strauss, and Giroux, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Progressive Insurance, working to make progress for more than 75 years. and by Organic Valley, a co-op of family farmers bringing organic half-and-half to America's morning coffee since 1988. Organic Valley, bringing the good. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Rosenthal from Juno Jazz and Classics, inviting you to join us for spectacular chamber music with the Vegas String Quartet on both Sunday, May 8th, featuring Mendelssohn's D major quartet and Mozart's quintet with Paul Rosenthal, and then again on May 12th at 7 p.m. at Holy Trinity Church with music by Haydn, Beethoven, and Brahms with guests Paul Rosenthal and Evan Drachman. Great music, great musicians. Tickets and more information at jazzandclassics.org.
Hey, welcome back to Juno Afternoon. With me are Corey McCrill and Sarah Bronstein of Juno Rides, and we're going to be talking about Bike to Work Day, as well as some of the work that the new group Juno Rides is working on to help ease folks' ability to ride bikes in our community. Welcome. Glad to have you here.
Thank you.
Why don't we start with what's at hand, and that is the Bike to Work Day on Friday. I'm so pleased, looking at the weather forecast, that it looks like the sun will cooperate on that day. Bike to Work is a national day, is that right?
Yeah, it's a national day all around the country. A lot of cities and communities hold events to celebrate getting to work in alternative fashion.
What's being planned here, Sarah?
So we have a bunch of activities planned for the day, starting in the morning. We are organizing commute stations throughout town. We've been doing this for 3 years now, and we have more stations this year than ever before. So there will be...
Now, are donuts involved?
There's no donuts, but wait.
Bacon?
There is bacon. The bacon is very popular. So we have a bacon station next to the Douglas Bridge at Cycle Alaska. There's also going to be a new bicycle-powered smoothie station this year at the Egan Bike Path at Mendenhall Loop Road. We're having bananas and bagels at the Twin Lakes Park station, and then there will be bike bells for the first 40 riders that show up at the UAS Rec Center. COPA is providing free drip coffee to cyclists, so... five different locations where you can stop by, and all of those locations either will have a mechanic on hand or a fix-a-flat stand so that you can pump up your tires and address any little loose screws that you've encountered along the ride.
So there are enough bike mechanics to person each of those stations then and give you some professional advice on how your rig is doing.
Right, yeah. We have an amazing relationship with Cycle Alaska, and they provide professional bike mechanic assistance during the morning. And so those stations will be open from 6 a.m. to 8:30 a.m., so all morning. And then after work, we encourage everyone to join us at the Alaskan Brewing Depot in downtown for a happy hour where there will be refreshments. It will have a slideshow running with photos from the morning. And we're working on collecting drawing prizes for the afternoon, so we should have some great prizes for people.
A day of fun, well worth getting on your two wheels and getting moving. What is the ultimate goal? Do you have, for example, a threshold you hope to reach in terms of folks on their bicycles riding that day?
Well, I think we'd like to try to get at least the same level of participation that we've had in previous years. Last year we estimate somewhere around 100 to maybe 150 riders participated in Bike to Work Day last year, just based on counting the number of people that came through the different commute stations. Mm-hmm. So the beautiful weather will definitely be a good encouragement for that.
So we have long had a group called the Juno Freewheelers, which has organized recreational activities for bikers, but you're forming a new group called Juno Rides. Why is that?
Well, Juno Rides was sort of born out of the Freewheelers' interest in expanding their mission to
to include more of an advocacy focus. And so the freewheelers still do their recreational riding activities during the summer, but now Juno Rides include some of the same members of the freewheelers, but under this new moniker, we're more focused on things like the bike to work day activities, and we also run a May long bike challenge where teams challenge each other to make as many trips as possible by bike in the month of May. So most recently, you know, we're working, of course, on bike month activities in May, but we're also updating the bike map, which we released last year. It was Juno's first map of dedicated road bike routes. It also includes mountain bike routes. So we just are working on making cycling safe, convenient, and fun in Alaska's capital city.
So weather aside, which we all get if we live here, what are some of the obstacles to make biking safe? I think you said safe, convenient, and fun. What kinds of additional advocacy do you see bike rides or Juno rides, pardon me, working on?
I think there's we really try to build awareness about how you get around town on a bike. I mean, I think even a lot of people that have lived here for a long time don't realize or haven't really thought about how, if you were going to bike, for example, from the valley to downtown, how you would do that, because obviously you can't ride your bike on Egan Drive. And so the bike map shows you, you know, the routes that you can take to get anywhere that you want in Juneau. And a lot of people just don't know about them, or they assume that it would be scary because you'd have to ride in traffic or something. So.
Is Juneau more of a bike-friendly place than people might realize?
I think that we have a long way to go before I would call Juneau a bike-friendly community, but it certainly is a beautiful place to ride, and there are a lot of amazing places to ride, whether you're doing a recreational ride out the road, whether you're riding through downtown where everything is so convenient, you can, you know, get where you need to go in a matter of minutes. And so we're working on helping people to see the opportunities to improve the infrastructure that we have in town, and also to get more people riding, like through our bike challenge and through bike to work day, because the more people that are out on the road, the more visible we all become and the safer we all become. So it's a two-sided coin of both helping to improve the facilities that we have available to us, whether that's on-road facilities like bike lanes and bike paths, or whether it's parking or having showers at your employers, to getting enough people out and riding that drivers are used to seeing us, and that drivers themselves may be cyclists, and so they have experience in both worlds.
If there were one or two things that our community could do to enhance the bike experience, what would those one or two top things be?
Well, I think number one is having an awareness of each other, and that's, you know, something that we encourage, is that people courteously share the road, which goes for everyone. You know, that we all are trying to get where we're going safely, and so it's important that we recognize the human driving whatever vehicle you happen to be riding alongside or driving alongside, and that we be respectful of each other's space.
Corey, did you want to add to that?
I also think that just along with the awareness, you know, becoming more aware of what the actual rules of the road are. I see a lot of drivers who get frustrated with cyclists because they think that they're supposed to be riding on the sidewalk instead of out in the lane or something like that, and that's not actually what the rules of the road are. And then on the, you know, conversely, you see cyclists doing things that are breaking normal rules of the road because they don't necessarily realize that a bike has to follow the same rules as other vehicles.
If someone's thinking about taking their bike out, as you said, Corey, you mentioned maybe riding from valley to town, and they're thinking, well, maybe I'll give it a go and try and get out of my neighborhood. What is a piece of advice you would give the more novice rider who's going to attempt longer distances? What thing should they know?
You should try riding on Bike to Work Day when there will be so many other riders out that you will have someone else to follow, and if you need assistance along the way, there will be people there to help you.
And it sounds like both Juno Freewheelers and Juno Rides are each good support groups as well.
Absolutely.
Well, we've been talking with Corey McCrill and Sarah Bronstein about Bike to Work Day. That'll be happening this Friday. There will be 5 stations at various locations around Juneau that will offer a variety of supports, and including a bike mechanic at each one of those stations. And the services will be available from 6:30 a.m. to 8:30 a.m. And at the end of the day, beginning, is it around 4 o'clock at the Alaska Brewing Depot downtown, there will be a happy hour to be happy about the Bike to Work Day. If you'd like more information, you can Google junorides.org. Is that right?
That's our website, yes.
Very good. So thank you for joining us today, and happy freewheeling.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Saturday morning, dreaming in bed. One little thought runs round my head. Summer is here, it's warm outside. Get my bike and ride, ride, ride. I brush my teeth, I comb my hair. I grab some toast, jump out of my chair. So long, folks, it's time to blow. I jump on my bike and go, go, go. I wanna ride my bike. Jump and dance, watch me win the Tour de France. Down the back street, round the pond, bet I'm faster than Greg LeMond. It's so great to be outside. What I like is to ride, ride, ride. I'm gonna ride my bike. I'm gonna ride my bike. Strawberry Hill, we have races, we have fun. We go fast as a horse can run. Every Saturday, what I like is getting outside and riding my bike. I'm gonna ride my bike.
Thanks for staying with us on a Juno afternoon. I'm Lori Scandling. With me in the studio is David Skidmore of Third Coast Percussion and Reggie Schapp. She is the executive director of Juno Jazz and Classics. And, of course, we are right in the middle of this wonderful 3-weekend May extravaganza of jazz and classics and, of course, always some blues as well. So welcome. Glad to have you here. David, give me a little bit of information. You are part of Third Coast Percussion. What do you play and what is that organization and that group doing so far in Juneau? I know you've done quite a bit and you've got more to go.
Yeah. So Third Coast Percussion is a classically trained quartet of percussionists. We're based in Chicago, but we tour all over the country and all over the world. This is our first time in Alaska, which is a lot of fun. And basically, our week in Juneau here is a good snapshot of what our organization does. We're doing a ton of work here, which we're really excited about. We started off with a concert on the Putnam on the Ritz sort of multi-artist concert on Sunday. We played a couple of pieces there. And then in addition to that, we've done a couple of workshops in the local high schools, and we've performed for some elementary school students this morning, and a couple of other educational and residency activities. Tonight, we're leading a workshop that is for basically any musician who wants to participate with us in the Juneau area. That's going to be 7 p.m. at the university in the Egan Library. Is that correct?
Egan Room. Yeah.
And that workshop will be centered around a really amazing piece of music called In C by composer Terry Riley. And so we're inviting anyone to come down and participate that wants to. And then tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the Juneau Arts and Cultural Center is our big concert. That's our feature concert called Music of Sound.
Tell us about the Music of Sound. Is that a participatory?
No, that's a more traditional concert. So we'll be playing a full evening of percussion music, which if you've never been to a percussion ensemble concert, many people haven't. It's a lot of fun. We play on some instruments you might expect, like drums, marimbas, which if you've never seen a marimba, it's like a big cousin of a xylophone. So there's melody and harmony and that sort of thing. But the other super cool thing about our group and what makes us really passionate about percussion music is that any object in the entire world can be a percussion instrument. So, for instance, we play a whole piece of music on an amplified tabletop. And there's these really carefully choreographed movements, and each movement makes a different sound. That's one of our pieces. We play another piece where we are using chopsticks on bamboo sushi mats and glass bottles. And it's all fun. A lot of it's, you know, some of it's lighthearted. Some of it's really sort of exciting and energetic music. And, yeah, I think it'll be a really fun evening.
Now, I understand there's an outdoor performance at UAS on Saturday. Talk about that. This is the John Luther Adams piece that is stunning, both visually and auditorily. Talk about that and how Juno may be involved.
Sure. So so John Luther Adams is an Alaskan composer, Pulitzer Prize-winning Alaskan composer, and he wrote this piece, which we'll be playing on Saturday, which is called Inuksuit. And the piece is for anywhere from 9 to 99 musicians. It's meant to be performed outdoors. And anyone out there listening who is a percussionist especially or a flute player or potentially another musician who's just interested in becoming involved, there's still an opportunity for people to participate. We've got, in addition to the four members of Third Coast Percussion, we've got about another 30 musicians already lined up, so it's promising to be a really big, epic performance of the piece. It'll also be at the university campus. And the piece, the experience of the piece, for those listeners who are more interested in coming to hear the performance, think of it like a cross between a concert and a sound installation. So we'll be outside. We're hoping for good weather. Looks like a pretty good forecast. And rather than being fixed in a seated position, the audience walks around. So you walk, you know, wherever you want to, and you sort of customize the performance for what you want to hear. And without giving away too much, basically the piece starts with all the performers in one area, and the performers move further and further apart as the piece progresses, and it has this very big dramatic arc, musical arc to the piece. It'll be unlike anything anyone's ever heard, and it's actually a pretty moving experience.
If someone wanted to participate and had some understanding of percussion, which is much broader definition than just a set of drums and drumsticks, how could they get involved with that? Because you can accommodate up to 99 percussionists in the piece.
That's right. So the most important thing is if they want to participate, they should contact us very soon, because coordinating the entire performance is a logistical challenge, a fun one, but a challenge nonetheless. So the best thing to do would be to contact Juneau Jazz and Classics or contact Third Coast Percussion directly, info@thirdcoastpercussion.com. And either way, we'll sort of get you all the information that you need, you know, which instruments you'll need to provide, that sort of thing. And the important dates are Friday, there's a rehearsal, mandatory rehearsal in the afternoon. And then, of course, Saturday is the performance. It was a dress rehearsal in the morning, performance at 2 p.m.
2 p.m. on Saturday. I do encourage anyone who is at all interested in learning more about Inuksuit by John Luther Adams, who is from Fairbanks, to Google it on YouTube and take a look at it. It's a stunning piece of work that I think would be very hard to describe, but it does accommodate lots of participants who have some understanding of how to be part of it in a percussive way. Quite an interesting variety of instruments were in that. Have you seen that, Reggie? Have you seen it live?
I have not seen it live, and I'm actually going to miss it because I'm going to be setting up Mavis Staples. But I hope everyone goes out. The part I've looked at was done in Minneapolis, and it was absolutely beautiful. I think it's been quite an experience.
And one of the great things about the piece, of course, John Luther Adams, Alaskan composer, and this piece has now been done all over the world. It's been done in London and the Netherlands, New York,
Denmark.
Chicago, Denmark. But this is actually the Alaskan premiere. So,
how ironic and exciting at the same time.
Yeah.
David, my understanding of percussion certainly was limited until I looked at this piece and saw how many different instruments were involved that qualified as a percussion instrument. What variety do you play as part of this quartet?
So myself and all of my colleagues in the quartet, we all, none of us really specialize in it on one particular instrument. We all play all of the percussion instruments, and sometimes that means learning a new instrument for a new piece. Sometimes it means playing a bunch of different instruments on one piece. So just to give you an idea of the range, for Inuksuit, some of us play large setups of drums. We have really simple friction instruments like sandpaper blocks that you rub together to create a sound. Lengths of tube that if you kind of wave around in your head and make a sort of a wind sound. And in our concert tomorrow night at the Jack, we play, I mentioned a piece that's music created all with a tabletop. We have another piece that's for 26 chromatically tuned Japanese prayer bowls, these beautiful objects that we had a new piece written for. I think, as far as we know, we're the only musicians in the world that own this particular type of set of instruments like this. And then on that same concert, we'll be playing, as I mentioned, marimbas, vibraphones, drums, some of the more, I guess, typical percussion instruments.
Before we go, I have to ask, what is Third Coast?
The Third Coast is Lake Michigan. It's an homage to our hometown of Chicago.
I was going to ask if it might be the Great Lakes area. Yeah. We're talking with David Skidmore, who is with the Third Coast Percussion Group, and they have a number of activities and performances coming up. Let me see if I can go through them, and Reggie or David can correct me. There is a workshop this evening at the Egan Library at UAS on percussion instruments, and I'm working on a particular piece. Is that correct?
That's right, and it's open to other instrumentalists, not just percussionists.
Is it free, or is there a charge for that one?
There is a charge, $25 to participate, $10 to audit the class.
Okay, and again, that's 7 tonight at the Egan Library out on campus. Tomorrow evening at 7 p.m. at the Jack, the quartet will be performing a particular piece. And give me that name again, David.
We're performing a whole concert, and the name of the concert is Music of Sound.
Music of Sound.
But that's our feature concert for our time at the festival here.
And, Reggie, tickets for tomorrow night's performance
are still available either at the Jack, Hearthside Books, or online at jazzandclassics.org. And I also wanted to say that anyone who is participating in Inuksuit can take the percussion class free as part of our gift for them coming to be part of that event
percussion
for
class
us.
This evening.
The workshop this evening.
And finally, Inuksuit, which is a beautiful piece composed by the Fairbanks composer John Luther Adams, will be performed Saturday at 2 o'clock outdoors at UAS. I encourage folks to please go and experience this surround sound opportunity. If you are interested in being a percussionist in Inuksuit, please contact info@thirdcoastpercussion.com or call Juno Jazz and Classics.
Or Jazz and Classics.
What's your phone number, Reggie?
It's 463-3378.
And if you are interested in participating, there is a rehearsal on Friday, and you can take tonight's workshop for free. Thank you very much. This is all very exciting.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Years ago, on an African expedition with his uncle, the young French ornithologist Jules Verreaux noticed that turricos had a hard time flying when they were wet. Turricos are silky-plumed, crested birds with exotic green, red, and blue plumage. So the young explorer grabbed one of these wet, grounded birds by the wing, only to find that it stained his hand blood red. He tried it with three more wet turricos, the same result. This mysterious pigment caught the interest of Verreaux's contemporaries, who experimented by dyeing paper with the beautiful rose-red liquid. And European cosmetics makers were enchanted. They hoped to produce a turrico solution that they could sell as blush. Unfortunately for them, their commercial dream died when chemists discovered that the pigment was soluble only in alkali solutions. It turns out that when he touched the wet birds, Verreaux must have had soap on his hands. As for the widespread notion that the brilliant red of the turrico's wing feathers is washed out in heavy rain, the authoritative Handbook of the Birds of the World describes it as a long-perpetuated fallacy. And so, turricos still fly unmolested in all their glory through the woodlands and savanna of sub-Saharan Africa. For BirdNote, I'm Mary McCann.
Mondays are back at the Diamond Park Aquatic Center, now open Monday through Friday from 6 a.m. until 8 p.m., Saturdays 9 a.m. until 6 p.m., and Sundays noon until 6 p.m. Schedules are available online at juno.org/parkrec/Diamond Park. For more information, call Diamond Park Aquatic Center at 586-2782.
Let's take a quick look at the weather. Tonight, rain in the evening, then showers late, lows around 46. Southeast wind 10 to 20. Tomorrow, numerous showers, high around 56. Southeast winds 15 in the morning, becoming light and variable. Wednesday evening, mostly cloudy. Showers only isolated. Thursday, improving to partly cloudy with highs around 61, northwest winds at 10. By Thursday night, mostly clear, lows around 45, northwest wind at 10. And Friday, the magic word, sunny, highs around 66. Friday night, mostly cloudy, lows around 47. And the weekend looking partly or mostly cloudy with highs in the high 50s. Tomorrow afternoon, on a Juno afternoon, we'll talk with Roman Kim and Maxine Pakamoff about their performances as part of Juno Jazz and Classics. We'll talk with Molly Porter from Head Start and Nikki Love from the Association for the Education of Young Children about the push for early enrollment. We'll learn about Kids to Parks Day with Sean Isley of Discovery Southeast and Sarah Tarver from Juno Parks and Rec. And we'll get a preview of Wednesday's town meeting about Juno's waterfront development with Chris Myrtle from Corvus Design. That Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more tomorrow afternoon on Juno Afternoon. And I'd like to thank Jeff for the great music we had today. Join us tomorrow at 3 o'clock on KTOO.